The following episode of FOFOP is rated MA. It contains alternating hosts, a rotating roster of guests, and mild coarse language. FOFOP advises that it is not suitable for anyone under the age of 15 or anyone who came here looking for one of those highbrow NPR-type podcasts. Minors must be accompanied by a parent or guardian. This is John Deek speaking.
Hello and welcome to FOFOP. My name is Charlie Clawson, and my guest this week is an actor. You probably know him best as Andy Barrett from Home and Away, one of those troublesome brothers from Yabby Creek. But more recently, he's turned his hand to writing and directing. It is, of course, Ty Hara. Ty, welcome to FOFOP, your FOFOP debut.
Yeah, my FOFOP debut. Thanks for having me, Mr. Maguire.
So you and I met on the set of Home and Away. You were brought in as a bad guy. I was very different introductions to Home and Away. I came in as a good guy. You came in as a bad guy. What was that like? Because Home and Away fans, you know, they're pretty loyal, and you know, they sometimes have a hard time differentiating between actors and characters. Did you find any blowback for being a Yabby Creek thug?
Yeah, well, you know what? I came in to mess with the River Boys, the family, the Bra Boys of the show. So to be honest, I thought I was going to have a lot of pushback, but yeah, people just ended up accepting that we were just kind of the dicks. we're there to mess things up. I think people just love the tension. They love rival families. And surprisingly, we didn't actually get that much pushback. It was pretty nice.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. You hear stories. I remember, you know, in the 80s when Neighbours was like, you know, the biggest show in Australia and especially in the UK. And, you know, one of the beloved characters, Daphne, was killed by like a drunk driver. The actor who played that drunk driver is Greg Fleet, the comedian, and he talks about like getting death threats and not even being able to walk down the street because people are like, Daphne, you killed Daphne. I mean,
people take it seriously.
Yeah. Was there any of that? Like, especially when your character got established? I mean, you know, you stole my girlfriend on the show. I think you came on and stole my girlfriend at one point.
But I think if you're an audience member, you were probably, you know, you were pushing for Andy to do that. You know, Zach wasn't the coolest cat around. When my character inadvertently helped kill Casey, one of the most loved characters on the show, I definitely got a bit of pushback. I think actually you and I were sitting at Telethon signing at a desk one day, and someone came up and was screaming at us, and you turned to me and were like, "That's terrifying. We got to get out of here." But no, I think people could still distinguish the difference between myself and Andy, but I do know other characters on the show, other cast members who have got into blues on nights out. I remember Lincoln actually got punched maybe twice.
Oh, really?
I mean, yeah. I don't know what it was for, but maybe they had a bigger stick with Casey than it was with Andy.
I think that's probably less the character and more the fact that, you know, someone's on TV and someone wants to be a hero in front of their mates or something like that, and you know, take an actor down a peg or two. I mean, so you guys, it's a different experience. The way you came to Home and Away, because I wasn't like, I'm a fucking veteran. I'm an old veteran by the time I entered the show. So there's a different kind of response. I always said to people, like, Home and Away is kind of, you know, a great show if you're a young actor coming in just to cut your teeth and, you know, just get your hours up and stuff. Or if you're an actor looking to go off into retirement. I was sort of right in the middle. You know, I'm neither a young actor nor an actor looking to retire. So, you know, I think I sort of flew under the radar a bit. But, you know, for the younger actors on the show, it's an awful amount of attention. I mean, was it the biggest show you had done to that point?
Yeah, definitely. It was my break into the industry. And I was only 23 years old. So even though I played older on the show, it was still a really brand new, fresh world for me. And kind of like my first taste of what the industry was all about. And yeah, I mean, there's a lot of spotlight and a lot of eyes on you, that's for sure. And I think at the time, it kind of comes into your consciousness a little bit, but at the same time, it doesn't. You're so young. You take for granted how massive an undertaking this is and kind of the opportunity that you have. So, I mean, by all means, I knew that it was an incredible opportunity and experience, but I think in terms of the gravitas of how big the show was, didn't really hit me at the time.
Yeah, I think that it only sort of really struck me when Jem and I went back to Scotland. You know, Jem's from a little town in the borders, and I didn't even really sort of think of it, but obviously, you know, Home and Away is really big in the UK. And so just walking around this little town in the borders, and people started going, is that the principal from Summer Bay High? Like, what's he doing in Scotland? Like, it must have just been so weird for them to see this guy where it's always sunny, you know, like Australian accents and stuff. And then, you know, you see me eating a sausage roll outside Greg's, you know, in this little border town in Scotland.
Yeah, that was a crazy thing. Whenever Philly and I would travel, people would come up to us and come and say hello. And they'd be from all different parts of the world, from Belgium, from Ireland, from the UK. And that's when it really sinks in how far and wide the show goes. But even as a kid, Mum used to plot me and the sister in front of the TV, and we'd watch Home and Away every night. So it was kind of a surreal experience to become a cast member as like one of my first major gigs in the industry, on a show that I'd kind of grown up watching and a show that's so iconic.
Yeah. So, I guess that's
all Australians.
Yeah. I mean, because I never really watched Home and Away. I think it was just the age I was at. Neighbours,
weren't you? You weren't you?
I was a Melbourne guy and I was a Neighbours guy. But I think, like, you know, Neighbours, Home and Away didn't start to the late 80s. And I think by then I'd sort of outgrown watching soap. But for, you know, I remember when I did Neighbours, like for Jem, she's the same as me. She grew up watching Neighbours and Scott and Charlene and all that kind of stuff. It blew her mind, like, because she came to visit me on set and she was on Ramsey Street and there's like Toadie and, you know, all these kind of things. And you're right. You do sort of just like take it for granted. I also think there's a thing in Australia, especially, well, there's, you know, there's the tall poppy thing, but there's that thing in Australia about downplaying everything. Like, I think a lot of Australians, particularly actors, have a real workmanlike attitude when it comes to a job. Like, no one starts on a show like that, you know, and thinks, oh, you know, well, I'm a star now. Like, it's just more kind of, oh, this is a job and you just sort of turn up each day and these are your lines, you got to learn them, blah, blah, blah. I think it's only, you know, once you start sort of, like you say, traveling and realizing what the reach of the show is. I found it like a really...
There's definitely people across all those shows that still come on and think they're a bit of a star from the start.
Yeah. Obviously, like there's always going to be those examples. But I think what I mean is it's not like in America where there's, because, you know, it's not like on Home and Away, we didn't even get catering in studio. Like, no one's really getting star treatment. Yeah. Sure, you can think you're a star and act like a star, but you're still buying your lunch from a cafeteria with, you know, a bunch of IT dudes. You know what I mean? So it's like
a settee.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's definitely a lot more down to earth. And it is, even the setups and the way that we all share the green room and that kind of, that feeling in itself is just a lot more, I guess, grounded and rooted in a little bit more reality.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. I was talking to Adam Zwar a while back on this show, because he spent quite a bit of time in the States, and just talking about the differences between the kind of two industries. And I was saying that, I reckon the reason why Australian actors, you know, per capita, like by our population, we do so well in the entertainment industry is because to actually sort of make it in Australia, to actually have a career over here, you've either got to be really hardworking and dedicated because there's not a lot of opportunities, or you've got to be really talented that, you know, you're getting the work. So either of those two things puts you in good stead when you actually get to a market where, you know, I don't know what you felt like when you got to the States for the first time, but you're like, oh my God, like this is a genuine, respected, big industry where there's lots of avenues for entry and people take it seriously. Like, it took me the longest time to admit to people that I was an actor. Like, I sort of was, it always felt like, you know, for the first 5 or 6 years, even though I was working, it just felt like a silly thing to say, like, because it didn't feel like a real job or anything like that. And then, you know, again, it's that tall poppy thing. You sort of feel apologetic for it. And then you go to a country where that's a $1 billion industry. And, you know, they don't respond to that self-deprecating sense of humor that most Aussies, you know, that I know have about their own careers. You know, I've done a few things, I've done this and that. They're like, oh, okay, well, if you've only done a few things, I'm not really that interested. It's that gear shift where you have to, you know, work at how to hustle and talk yourself up and, you know, in a way that doesn't make you want to have a shower straight afterwards.
Yeah, and lie down and cry.
Yeah.
No, it's definitely overwhelming for the first time when you get over there. And everyone that you meet pretty much has some involvement in some way or another with the industry.
Mm.
But I think I was really very much the same as you as well in terms of not knowing how to tell people. I was an actor all the time, you know, early on. And because the question you always get is like, oh, well, what have you been in? What do I know you from?
That's the worst.
And until you actually have a bit of a body of work behind you, not much. Maybe, do you remember an Ergon Energy ad from 2009? So yeah, it's definitely a shift, but also getting on the ground over there, it is such a highly respected industry. It's got so much money behind it. But just the sheer number of projects and opportunities there are. So obviously there's so much more room for downfall and to miss out on things, but there's also on the other end of the spectrum, there's so many things and opportunities that you can be going for all the time as well. So there's good and bad with going over there, I feel like.
Yeah.
I think it can be so inspiring to be around so many people that are so
motivated.
Driven and want to be part of this industry and want to make a name for themselves. But then at the same time, it can be draining as well. So I think that's the balance of being over in the States. And that's one thing that Aussies have as a luxury is that, I mean, pre-coronavirus is that if anything went wrong, you can just get on the plane and go home and it's not that bad, you know?
Yeah.
I feel like that's a gateway out as well.
Yeah, if Australia's your fallback position, then it's a pretty good fallback.
I mean, not doing too bad.
I agree with you. It's funny, like before the first time I went to the States, I just remember a lot of people warning me about, oh, there's so much bullshit and there's so much kind of like, what do they call it, the glass of water meeting where you get hyped up and everyone wants to, you know, seem so enthusiastic, but all you get out of it is a glass of water. But I found it refreshing. Like I knew it was bullshit, but it was nice to hear some bullshit, you know, after years of like, you know, it's like feast or famine, you know, not really feeling like there was any interest in me or any a potential for projects I wanted to develop or whatever, to actually have someone show some interest. It's just a bit of a shot in the arm. Like, I don't know. I feel like you, I feel like it's a bit of a love-hate thing. You know, you want to kind of crack that market because obviously it's so huge. And like you say, the upside is so big. But at the same time, I do wonder whether my integrity is compromised by being over there, because am I adapting myself and the things I want to do for a market, you know, because I want a bite of the cherry, or am I still making things that I genuinely want to make? Like, I know this is the artist dilemma in general. Like, you know, you want to create work that has meaning and that you believe in, but you also want to make money. So you want it to be commercial and successful. But I feel like this, you know, when the pandemic happened, Gemma and I, you know, we had our visas and we were umming and ahhing about where do we base ourselves. And when that got taken off the table without any influence by us, it was a real relief. You know, it was weird because we just had a baby. You know, we had some things in development, but we just weren't sure where we wanted to be. And then that was just taken off the table. And we've actually been able to concentrate in being in Australia. And I think that, you know, fingers crossed. I know you guys are in the middle of a lockdown right now and it's horrible, but the amount of production that's come to Australia, there seems to be more of an investment in local production. You know, hopefully the government holds a line with these streaming services and their quota and all that kind of stuff. If we can somehow have our cake and eat it too, then that's the best of both worlds, really, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And I think we've had this conversation in the past as well of the lure of the States as well is that things can change overnight. It's one of those places that, yes, everyone is willing to have a meeting with you and take the time out of their day, but something so small can turn into a huge opportunity in the blink of an eye. But yeah, going back to being here and being content in Australia, I think it's maybe taken a world pandemic for a lot of people in our industry to realize that we have a thriving industry over here and something that we should be super grateful of as well.
Yeah.
And I think that that now with the way that the industry is moving, and also the luxury of being able to do things like self-tape at home and be anywhere you need to, which wasn't around, you know, 10, 15 years ago, really opens it up that it can change, I guess, your perspective and your values of what you want, because, you know, acting is obviously our profession and it's something we value so much, but there's got to be a balance to personal lifestyle as well. And even friends that are working on huge productions in Toronto or wherever it is in the world still long to come home and be, you know, in their sanctuary, whether it be Currumbin on the Gold Coast or, you know, St. Kilda down in Melbourne, just these spots that, that when you're away from home, you really feel it.
Yeah. I think that Chris Hemsworth was the one who seemed to crack the code, right? Because the path that had been laid out for however many years was that you do your time in Australia, get some credits up, then you go to the States and you try and crack it and you base yourself in LA for however long. And then he gets to a point where his career is so kind of rock solid and successful. He's like, you know what? I think I've got a pretty good thing going back home. I'm just going to go back to Australia and productions can come here. And it worked. Yeah. And it's such a monumental shift, because there is no reason why Australia couldn't be like a production destination. We have the space for it. We have the crews. We have the weather. You know, like Australia, the first feature film was made in Australia. It was, you know, the Kelly Gang in the 20s or something. And Australia was poised to become like the Hollywood of the world. And then nothing's changed in 90 plus years. You know, the government's like, well, we're not back in the arts. We're going to put our attention elsewhere. And then everything moved to California and the rest is history. But, you know, you just feel like, I mean, I know from a lot of the crew I talk to, they're flat out. Everyone's booked on jobs. It's almost impossible to get people. And you just hope that it's not like a bubble that bursts once everyone's vaccinated and things open up. You know, you just want to sort of see either that, you know, foreign productions without, you know, just the money they get on the exchange rate and stuff, but they genuinely want to come here because the studios are top notch, the crews are top notch. What I would like to see more of is that, rather than just, you know, crews getting employed, but people who are, you know, writers and directors and stuff, that they start getting given opportunities. Because at the moment, it still very much feels, it feels like it's heads of department are all still being flown in, and that's fine. You know, it's their production, their money, they can do what they want. But what would be excellent would be, you know, more mentorship programs, you know, and giving, not just like set visits and stuff, but like genuine, like structured programs where, you know, someone like yourself who's just sort of moved into writing and directing could apply, you know, and, you know, if they think that you're the right person, they bring you in and you can shadow, you know, the director of The Young Rock or something for 6 weeks. I think that would be great. I don't know how, you know, Screen Oz or whatever, you know, a body has to set that up, but that would be the best outcome.
Yeah, I think there's such a wealth of talent down here. And obviously with the investment in studios, like they're making one in Ballina, Crows just announced one in Coffs Harbour.
I know. It's amazing. It's so funny.
The banana capital.
Yeah.
But I feel like all of those are only moving us towards making Australia a more thriving industry, because like you said, we've got phenomenal talent down here, but for the most part, people go overseas to set their careers up. And that also just comes down to a demographic, because really, you know, what, we're 26 million people. You've got 330 million people over there. The eyes you're going to get on the shows, the budgets and everything, the projects are going to be bigger. So people are going to go and chase that. But I think with more offshore productions coming to Australia, it's going to give local talent more experience without having to leave. And hopefully that trickles down, like you said, not just with actors, but on all sides with crew as well. That we're making more content down here. And not only that actors want to stay here and their crew want to stay here, but that people want to bring their productions down here too.
Does it ever take you out of the moment though, when you're watching a TV show or a movie that was shot in Australia and like you recognize the street? Like I've been watching The Young Rock, which was shot in Brisbane, and they're doubling it for like Florida and Hawaii. And I'm like, what are you talking about?
that's the Story Bridge.
That's the Gold Coast. That's Surfers Paradise.
Yeah, it does. But they do it pretty well, don't you reckon? But yeah, no, it definitely does. Like when you're watching areas and you see the Mullumbimby markets pop up in Handmaid's Tale. No.
Yeah, it's one of those things, isn't it? Where it's like, I think maybe 15 years ago, it was more of a, you know, that kind of stuff was more ropey, you know, less believable. You'd have a lot of extras who are doing like pretty dodgy American accents. But nowadays, I mean, this is actually something I wanted to ask you because, you know, as an actor who went through drama school, you know, only what, 10 years ago, was there more of a focus? Because I sort of feel like for my generation, like, you know, 10 years above you, that the America thing was still, you know, it was pie in the sky. It was very rare, you know, that people would head over. The majority would just try and make a career here. But I feel like there's been a shift where because of Hemsworth and Margot Robbie and stuff, a lot of actors, younger actors are like, okay, this is my two steps to stardom is like, I'll get out of drama school, land a soap and go to Hollywood or even bypass the soap altogether. I'm just going to finish drama school and go straight to Hollywood. Did you feel that was, you know, your classmates, was that the idea?
Yeah, there was definitely a push for the States. And with graduates that had been out 10 years above us, they were starting to have some success over there. You know, people like Mikey Dorman I'm just having a complete blank now. But, you know, I mean, there were people that were doing really well over there. So there was a push from our heads to move towards film and television and to go for those things. There was agent meetings with American managers and agents pretty close to Showcase, which even for the most part before our time, that had never really happened before.
Right.
But I definitely had friends that finished around the same time as me that decided not to do the Australian thing. They just went straight to the States.
Yeah.
And they slogged it out. Some either stayed there long enough that they pushed their way into the industry. Others kind of came back and forth. But I think for our generation, it's just part and parcel that you're going to live between both.
Yeah.
And that was just the reality when we were coming into the industry. We just knew that we wanted to be working over there as well.
And I think like you were saying before about screen test, you know, auditions, you can shoot something on your phone and upload it in 15 seconds. Like, I mean, I'm going to sound like I'm a million years old, but back in the day, mate, like you'd have to book a casting studio and get them to shoot it and they would put it onto like a DVD that you would then fucking pop in the post and send over like express post to the States.
That's crazy. I remember Andrew McFarlane telling me about when he finished from NIDA, which I don't know when it was. I don't want to say a year to offend him. But I'm pretty sure casting agents used to send out the scripts by a post back then. it's definitely changed a bit.
How do you feel about, because I had a mate who was staying with me a few weeks ago, an actor, and he had to do a couple of self-tapes and he was really furious about it. Like he thinks that, so for people listening who may not be familiar with what we're talking about, two bloody actors getting all bloody actory talk. So a self-tape is ordinarily, you know, pre-pandemic, when you had an audition, you would go to a casting studio, which is, you know, just an office somewhere where someone's set up with a camera where you go in and you audition. Sometimes the director's there, but more often than not, you're just reading with the casting agent. But in the era of contactlessness, casting agents now send you a brief and you just record it in your living room or whatever on your phone, like I said. Now, my mate was saying it's bullshit because we are now doing the work of the casting agent. Like, you now as the actor, the onus on you is to shoot this thing, find a reader, which is always difficult, especially, I don't know what, you know, the relationship with you and fella's like, but Jem is like, she's done. She's like, no more. I'm not fucking reading with you. I'm not an actor.
Had this yesterday, Phil just said, fucking stop making me read for you. And we were trying to keep quiet while we were doing it as well. It's great when you've got a 9-month-old daughter who loves to speak midway through every scene.
Yeah. So.
But yeah.
He was saying like, it's just, this is, it's ridiculous. At the very least, they should be the ones setting up the Zoom audition. You know, why they're still getting the same fee. Why are we doing like 50% of the work? Which I never really thought about it, but I'm like, yeah, it's right. Because I can't remember, you know, even pre-pandemic, I can't remember the last time I was actually in a room for an audition.
Yeah, I don't want to sit on the fence with this one, but it's kind of a bit of both, because sometimes you have the luxury to put it down whenever you want. You don't have to jump in a car and be there at a specific time. But then you're required to do the wardrobe form every time. I mean, no, that's not a big deal. But, you know, you are required then to go and record this whole thing yourself, upload it, and basically in some way kind of do a bit of their job for them, you know?
Yeah.
But when I started in the industry, self-tapes for the States was only just starting to be a thing at the time, but no one was really booking a huge amount off it. And now the industry's changed so much that people are booking huge gigs off tapes from their home, and even doing test deals and things that you would always typically have to do in a studio or in front of networks in the past. So I don't know. It's kind of, it is good and bad. But I do think sometimes just being in the room and also knowing what they're looking for is definitely, you do lose a lot of that when you're doing everything from home, and it does fall on you and your relationships and the people that you have to call in and all the favors. It does become a bit more of a full-time job to just be taping all the time.
Yeah. And since I've moved up to the Northern Rivers too, it's like my circle of contacts that I can.
Now you just get Chris and Matt Damon, right?
Yeah,
and just
totally.
Call them up. And
yeah, I've got, it's not just Chris. Which Hemsworth do you want? There's like three to choose from, mate.
Yeah, true.
Depending on where I want my eye line to be, start with Chris and then lower all the way down to Luke. but I'm now doing this thing where it's just like I'll get someone on Zoom and I'll set up the laptop behind the camera. And I was thinking about this the other day. I'm like, this is not really acting anymore. Like auditioning isn't really acting. Auditioning is about getting a job. It's about letting people see what you look like, what you sound like, and, you know, presenting something that is going to pique their interest enough to bring you in again. But
and absolutely, sometimes people that are the best auditioners are definitely not the best actors. You know, there's an art form and there's a skill just to being able to audition well.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I've done a few like courses on auditioning and stuff, and you know, this idea is really, it's not about acting really. It's about standing out. It's about sort of surprising someone. Like if you put yourself in the shoes of the casting agent, they're looking at, you know, maybe 100 tapes over the, you know, for one role. And so if everyone in that tape is just doing it word perfect, couldn't fault them, but it's the same, then you just, after like the fifth tape, you're like, fuck, is every single person going to deliver these lines exactly the same way? And it's all well and good to say that, but you know, you want to create something different, but then sometimes it's hard. Like, I don't know if you're like me, but you'll look at a scene and you'll go, I see what they want to do here. And so your temptation is to give them what is on the page. You know, it's a scene where this guy's got to be a prick, so I'm just going to be a prick. But then in your head, you're like, but everyone's going to be doing this. Like, everyone's going to be going the same way. Well, then I need to do it my way. How would Charlie be a prick? And then you start, and that's when the trap starts, because then you start like overthinking.
Yeah, totally. And I think sometimes you just got to follow your instincts and go with what you read straight away. You don't want to overthink it. But then other times, you know, it is so important. Like you said, these people are having hundreds of tapes across their desk every day to stand out and do something different. You don't have to be line perfect. You don't have to be a finished product for the audition.
Well, that was the biggest lesson. You know, when Gemma and I started producing our own stuff, and you know, and I started going to auditions on the other side of the camera, that was the best lesson for me. Was like, you know, you generally you don't really remember the people who are kind of like word perfect, but unexceptional. You'll remember the guy who couldn't get through the scene because he didn't know the dialogue, but he's committed. You know, he's doing something. Yeah. I mean, it would sort of bug me on one hand. Like there's a few guys who came in clearly unprepared, you know, and just doing their own thing. And I would be like annoyed, the kind of like meticulous wanker actor in me would be like, motherfucker didn't even try. But then, you know, Jem or the casting agent would be like, oh no, I liked, you know, I liked what they did. They brought something different, something interesting. And then I was like, okay, well, that's really what this first audition is about, is just whether or not they want to see you again. You know, is there something worth pursuing here? And I think that, you know, you always hear those stories about actors who do something really radical. You know, they'll fucking pull a gun on the director or something like that.
Yeah, to show or that, spit at them or something.
Yeah. And you're always like, I fucking, if I tried that, never work again. Like, I'd be absolutely,
I know. I've got the exact same. One of my mates went to a casting in the States, and he'd just been at a big party the night before. I think he'd forgotten about it in the morning. He jumped in the pool. He was fully clothed. He drove to the audition, drenched with water. He walked in, he did it, he booked the role.
That's
if I did that, I think I'd be deported from the country. I'd probably be sent to Nauru. No, sorry, not just to drop Nauru. I mean, I was the president of that.
That's right. But, you played, was it the president of Nauru that you played? No, what was the...
It was. What, are you going to pick a different island for me?
No, I'm just wondering. Well, it's actually, it's a nice little dovetail into what I want to talk about next is you made a web series last year called Colorblind, which, well, I'll let you explain what it is and then we can talk about it. So tell people, what's the synopsis of Colorblind?
So Colorblind is based on my own personal experiences in the industry. It's an amalgamation of so many experiences over the years. And it follows the story of Gavin Walters, who's a white man who specializes in casting ethnic people.
So if you haven't determined from Ty's name, so Ty is half Japanese, but has the I mean, it's really like a great attribute as an actor. You have the ability to be cast as any ethnic type, right? Like you've auditioned or been cast as a bunch of different ethnicities.
Yeah, I have and I haven't. I think that's where the series came from as well, because there's so many gray areas, and I think that's exactly what everyone's trying to navigate right now and has been for the last little while, is the diversity movement, how to make the industry more inclusive and representative of different people. So on one hand, yes, I can pass for a million different ethnicities. But on the other hand, I can't go for things that are a specific ethnicity at certain times. So it's become this blanket thing now of people go, well, you're a POC, so, you know, this
must
is
be great
your time.
Yeah,
it's amazing. You're going to be nonstop working. But it's a lot more nuanced and complex than that. And I think that goes on all sides. So what Colorblind for me was really unpacking that, exploring it, and really making a comment on the industry, in the sense that we don't have all the answers. And I'm, for one, not pretending to be an expert on the field. But I definitely think there's still things that we can be doing to work towards making a more inclusive industry. And that's what I want to do with Colorblind. It is told through satire. I think that's the most palatable lens to be able to pull people into, you know, complex and tough conversations like this, and break it up through humor as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really funny series, and I encourage everyone to go check it out. I'll put a link in the description below this episode. But what I thought was actually, you know, one of the most powerful kind of supplementary bits of content you created for Colorblind was when you were retweeting, you had actors of color to share their stories. You know, what is the most insane thing you've been asked in a casting room? And just to see the sheer number of people who responded and the stuff that they were sharing was like, it's funny, isn't it? Because like you say, it's with good intentions, you know, that there is this diversity push, but there is... And that's, you know, and that's what the character, you know, your lead character encapsulates so well, is like, he's not a bad guy. You know, he thinks he's doing the right thing, but there's just this kind of like, you know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, you know, just this sort of ignorance in the form of like, well, I'm being affirmative action here, you know, like I'm giving someone an opportunity, but also not recognizing that people are individuals beyond the color of the skin or beyond their cultural background. Because as a white actor, it's never once been asked what my background is. No one ever says like, oh, so tell us a bit, you know, where you're from, like, or what's your heritage or anything like that.
Yeah, definitely. Gavin is this huge advocate for diversity in casting. He sees himself as an ally, but he's so misguided. And I think, as you mentioned, so many of the actors involved, when I first approached him about the project, I told them about my own experiences, and every single one of them had something to share, a lot of which I used in the series. And I think it is this hard thing we're all trying to navigate, because it's not about saying that the white stories or the Caucasian story isn't valid anymore. It's just about opening up so that everyone's story is valid and it's not tokenistic, that you're not just put in a box. And I think that's really important. And it's not something that's so easy, because, I mean, so many of my friends in Australia are Caucasian actors, and, you know, these are uncomfortable conversations to have with your friends. Yeah, we joke about things, but it also goes, well, where's my place in the industry for them? Yeah. And I don't think it's a matter of pushing one side out and bringing another side in, but it's definitely about figuring out how to make things a lot more inclusive. And that isn't just in regards to ethnicity. Obviously, that's what our series touches on, but it's across gender, sexuality, ability as well.
Yeah. Well, it's just about representation, isn't it? There was a really interesting Twitter thread that I just started following. I'm not sure if you saw it, but Josh Thomas kicked off a bit of a furor last year when some footage came up of him talking about, he was doing some panel and he was talking about, you know, the difficulty in casting minority characters and, you know, is it stereotypical to cast like an Indian actor as a convenience store clerk? And he was saying that, look, you know, it's hard to cast for diversity because a lot of people who have come from, you know, minority backgrounds maybe haven't been steeped in kind of like, you know, they don't prioritize drama. You don't have as many actors in this field. And I could see his point, which is like, well, yeah, like the talent pool, if you're casting for a specific ethnicity, the talent pool is going to be a lot smaller. So the chances of you finding an actor who is as accomplished as, you know, the 90% of white actors who graduate from all the drama schools around Australia probably isn't going to be as high. But then I saw Briggs, the rapper, jumped in and was like, yeah, but he's gone, how do you reckon people learn? Is they need an opportunity? He's gone, I wasn't an actor. Like, exactly. I hadn't done anything, but someone gave me an opportunity and I learned on the job. And I started like thinking, well, that's exactly how I got started. I mean, I didn't go to drama school either. I knew I wanted to be an actor. And so I just started like, you know, doing things like, you know, theater and all that kind of stuff and just applied my craft. But someone opened the door for me, gave me a chance. And then when I was on set, I was like, okay, it's up to me now to learn. And so I guess that is the white privilege of the door was open for me to step in and, you know, learn on the job. No one questioned how shit I was at the start. No one was like, well, we can't get that, you know, Irish Australian guy in because, you know, like, and I think that is the attitude that sort of needs to be applied, which is like, yeah, look, you maybe you're going to have to work a bit harder to get the performances to the level of, you know, the other actors who have been more steeped in, you know, dramatic training or whatever it is, but you've got to give the opportunities somewhere, right?
Yeah, and in all due respect to Josh, I think that is part of the problem, is making statements like that and saying that there isn't talent out there or it's not available is part of the problem, because
we should just say, in Josh's defense, he did completely apologize and walk back those stuff.
No, totally.
Yeah, yeah.
No, totally. Yeah, and I know Josh is a well-meaning person and he didn't mean in the interview as well, the way he said it, it wasn't attacking people. It was a perspective, which is so many people's perspective, which is valid. But you also have to understand that the reason that the industry is the way it is because the stories that have been written for it for so long, the opportunities that have been afforded to these actors beforehand, that is also a big reason why other ethnicities and other people haven't been given that doorway into the industry before. I mean, representation is such a huge part. When I was a kid growing up in Australia, I didn't switch on the TV and see myself really at all. And there was definitely, there's definitely elements of it, but even a report came out last year with news readers, and I think it's still something like in the 90s of news readers that are Caucasian. You know, it's about opening up the door for other opportunities, and I think that yes, quotas can be tokenistic, and there can be a certain element of it that can create tension and friction, amongst different parties. But the reality is that we need to do things to break it open. You know, we actually have to make an effort. Mm. You can sit here and you can talk about it, but unless you actually try and make meaningful change, nothing does change. So it's just something as simple as going, well, you know what, for my next project, I am going to try and look for half my crew to be POC or half my cast, you know, or when I'm writing this project, I'm not going to write it for a specific ethnicity. Yes, there are obviously going to be your personal experiences as a Caucasian male. You're going to write for what you know as well.
Mm.
But it's not to say that you can't just open it up so that it's more of a reflection of what our society is, what we are as a country, and seeing that on our screens and throughout all of the industry.
Yeah, and it's interesting too because, you know, that idea of, well, I only know my experience, that's just nonsense, you know, like bring in another writer, speak to other people, you know, like I think that's one of the great things I've been seeing, you know, happening is that, you know, it used to be because we had the monopoly on the stories that were being told, like you would literally see like, you know, a show being written about the outback with not one Indigenous writer or creative working on the show, but that has changed entirely now. And I think that's all for the better. How has Colorblind been received? Do you think it's been a generally like have people got the joke? Have people liked it? Have people been offended?
It's been received really, really well. I obviously when you're touching on something as complex as race, I had nervous parts of releasing this, and it's a deeply personal story as well. But I think the crux of it comes down to that is that it is based on real life experiences.
Yeah, it's not just like a political. It's not just a political statement. You're not out, you know, trying to kind of just like beat a drum for the sake of politics. Like this is it's a personal story. It just happens to intersect with, you know, a lot of political discourse at the moment.
Absolutely, and the whole reason behind making it is to shine light on it, but it's also a piece of work for people to enjoy.
Yeah, it's funny,
and maybe step away and have some reflection from as well. But I'm not coming out as a complete political movement trying to, you know, redefine
Ty Guevara.
But no, it's been received so well, with. So far, got into 10 festivals around the world as well. So it's actually been able to have that global reach and have other audiences experience quite an Australian story, but also something that's not just unique to Australia. It's something that we can all relate to.
I mean, I think the thing that makes it such a great series is you can sell it in a line, which is like, you know, a white ethnic casting specialist, you know, it's sort of like,
yeah,
like the irony is in the synopsis.
Yeah, totally. And I think people watching it, yeah, there's definitely a lot of cringe factor and that's from both sides. It doesn't matter if you're white or a POC. There's things that you're going to watch and really feel uncomfortable, but that's what it's meant to be. And we all know a Gavin, you know, we all know these people that are well-meaning, that are good people, but are misguided and don't necessarily have the tools or the capacity to be able to deal with these complex issues.
So can you tell me, or tell the audience, cause I know this story, there's a scene in, I think it's the second episode where you play yourself, and it's based on a real thing that happened to you, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. So it's actually one of the only moments in season one where Gavin is actually challenged by one of the actors, because the way the show's based is it's mockumentary, it's fly on the wall. So our whole intention was that you're in there in the casting room experiencing what these people experience, but with them as well. But that particular scene, Gavin asked me to recite something in Farsi, which actually happened to me in the States. So I went for an audition. I won't name the film. But I was going for an interpreter, and I did hit my agents up and first of all say, well, one, I'm not this ethnicity, and two, am I going to need to be able to speak Farsi? And I was assured I wasn't going to. And in all respect to them, I don't think it had been advised. But then when I did get there in the room in front of the six casting directors, I was asked to recite something. So yeah, it's those kind of situations that once again, it's hard to nail down. It's not one person's fault here. You know what I mean? It's a kind of a gray area that everyone's trying to navigate.
Yeah.
But in the series, Gavin does ask me to recite it, and I give it a go, and it goes horribly wrong, and it's this awkward exchange of him kind of just thanking me for my time, and it's clear that I'm not going to get the role.
I have a friend who's a Vietnamese actor, and he's played every flavor of Asian on the planet. He's played Chinese, Japanese, whatever. Yeah. And I think it was it Sea Patrol? I think it was Sea Patrol, where they wanted him to play like an Indonesian refugee. And he got the part, they just cast him. He didn't even have to audition. And he turned up on set and the director was taking him through the scene. And it's like, so when the boat pulls up, you're in your little dinghy and you just, but in Indonesian, just call out, help, help, help me, help me. And he's like, in Indonesian. And the director's like, yeah. And he's like, I don't know Indonesian, I'm Vietnamese. And he's just like,
amazing.
Oh, well, can you just do so? Just say anything. Can you just say anything that sounds kind of Indonesian? He's like, I don't know what Indonesian sounds like. I'm Vietnamese. Like, I've never spoken it before in my life.
Yeah, it's amazing. And I mean, that's all part of it as well, isn't it? It's the ignorance. And I think the industry has come a long way, but for a lot of people as well, like, it is just ignorance. It's not knowing or not trying hard enough. But I have a feeling that that's shifting and changing, and hopefully it's a tough conversation, but it's something that's super important to making the industry more vibrant.
Yeah. And you've bitten off a lot in the last 12 months, haven't you? Like, you decided to get a dog, have a baby, and write and direct and produce your own web series all at the same time. Like, you didn't think of maybe spacing these things out at some stage?
Yeah, no, I thought I'd just throw them all together in the blender and see how it went. No, it's well, the baby actually was pre-pandemic, so we found out, and then the world imploded, so that was amazing. Right.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's actually been the best time to do all these things, to work on my own projects, to spend time with my little family.
Well, I mean, the listeners really can't see this, but Ty is actually, he's commandeered his daughter's nursery. He's actually virtually sitting in her crib now.
I'm actually sitting in her cot, aren't I?
Yeah.
This is where I sleep now. Yeah, Fel's put me in here.
It's the quietest room. But how is it?
And I'm learning to read again, which is great.
So. And colors and everything. It's great.
Yeah, colors. Yeah.
But how has it been? Like, how has it been adjusting to fatherhood with all this other stuff going on? Because I know for me, like, all my projects, it's taken almost like, you know, I'm only now just sort of getting back to things, and it's been 18 months. I mean, there's a lot of other stuff I had going on. We moved house and, you know, a bunch of other stuff happened in between as well. But how are you balancing being a father and also being a self-generating artist?
Yeah, I think I'm really fortunate, as you are with Gemma, that my wife, Feli, is such a support network. She'll let me get away and write when I can or when I need to. But yeah, it's definitely become harder, and you need to routine and schedule in things a lot more than I used to in the past, when I could just crack a bottle of wine and sit up and have a.
Oh my God. Do you remember what it used to be like when it's like, I mean, what did we used to do with our time? Like, I could spend an entire day just piss farting around, you know, maybe a sentence here, a sentence there. Now, if you get 2 hours, it's like, fucking hell.
Oh. I know. I'd stop and think about sometimes. I'm like, wait, remember I just used to go for a walk for 3 hours along the coast? That's never happening again.
Never.
No, now I bring them all with me.
Yeah.
No, it's been definitely an adjustment. And to be honest, finding time to write and be creative at times can be really hard. But I think it's learning to find a balance, you know?
Yeah. I think it's also just setting achievable goals, because the worst thing you can do is go, all right, well, I'm going to punch out, you know, a script in by the end of the month or whatever it is. And it's like, you just got to be a bit more flexible. And like what I'm trying to do at the moment is, if I can just tick off like 2 hours of work a day. So, you know, either when she's napping or at night, you know, I've got like a shit ton of podcasts to record at the moment because it's footy season. So, you know, that takes up a lot of time, but I'm just chipping away at, there's a writer I follow on Twitter, and his advice is just write 3 pages a day. Doesn't matter, you know, how good they are or not. Just if you can write 3 pages a day for a year, you'll have 3 screenplays by the end of the year. And it's gone. If you write more, then great, but make that your minimum. Just write those 3 pages and then you can go for your 3-hour walk or, you know, feed your kid or whatever. And so that's the kind of philosophy, not just with writing, but I'm trying to apply to everything, is like, because at the moment I'm recording, I've got 3 different podcasts I do. I've got a shot some new web like comedy stuff that I'm editing at the moment. I'm applying for like a feature kind of attachment. I'm trying to do a new draft of a film. I'm working on a TV pitch. Like there's about 10 things going on. And
do you want to make me feel like any more of a slacker?
No. But here's the thing, dude. I am doing like little nibble here, little nibble there. And sometimes I forget, like, our mate Richie, who's, you know, the star, Alan Mercedes, for people who follow my work closely. If you've ever been to the TOEFOP TV, the TOEFOP YouTube page, Richie, who plays Alan Mercedes, we just shot a whole bunch of stuff. Well, when I say a whole bunch, we've shot 4 new sketches. And I literally had forgotten that we shot them because I just like dad brain and all this other stuff. And Richie just texted me today to be like, hey, man, it's been like a month. Can I see the rough cut? And I'm like, holy shit, I haven't even got round to it. So now I'm like, okay, I'll just throw that up on the whiteboard. These are just a little bite here, a little bite there, and a little bite there. And I think, you know, it's hard because you've got to try and balance stuff that brings in an income with stuff that you want to do. But as long as you keep working, I think that I wasn't depressed a couple of weeks ago, but I could feel myself heading into that kind of like, what's the fucking point? You know,
like,
what's the point of any of this shit? Because so much of what you do is in isolation, and there's no financial reward, or there's no obvious kind of, you know, you're not even sure if it's going to get made, but you've got to just kind of chip away at it. And, you know, I sort of felt myself getting to that negative mindset. And then I just had to sort of flip it on its head and go, how amazing that I can actually work on these things. Like, you know, I'm not at a point in my life where I'm earning the most amount of money, but I'm earning enough that I can chip away at little things. And, you know, I have to take jobs when they come up, obviously, and everything will be put aside when that happens. But it's just more about, without sounding like a wanker, but it's embracing the process. The fact that stuff doesn't come to you overnight. Like Jem is tearing her hair out at the moment because of this thing we've been working on for ages, because I keep like umming and ahhing about, I don't know if this is the right direction. And then she sort of just suggested yesterday about getting another writer in. And at first I was like offended, and then I was like, that might actually fucking help, you know, just to sort of be a circuit breaker, just to bring someone in, pay them, and just like say, can you work with me for a month where we can just like thrash this idea out, and then I'll go and write the draft. But I just feel like I need just to, you know, just some kind of circuit breaker.
Yeah, sometimes you just need to sit there and do it yourself. But I'm a huge advocate for collaborating. I feel like it brings the best out in me creatively. And like you said, sometimes you spiral and you get into those places where, you know, you are questioning things a lot. And it helps to be able to have other people around you that are inspiring and doing their own work or like-minded to help you kind of kick things along. But I think that advice you got from the writer is amazing. If I can have 3 screenplays by the end of the year, fuck, I'll be stoked.
Yeah. It's just going to be those 3 pages. That's a thing.
Yeah. But it is, creativity is such a futile thing. If you're not inspired, it can be really hard to manifest something or manufacture something out of thin air. So it is about, just as much looking after yourself and finding that balance and setting aside the time, right?
Yeah. Giving yourself victories. Like it's going to hurt if everything you're working on feels like it's just going into the void. But, you know, we all have iPhones. I mean, that's what we shot Lessons for Life on. It was just like Richie was in town for 2 days. So we spent a day brainstorming an idea. I stayed up all night and wrote 6 scripts and then we just went out and shot it. And, yeah, it's fucking rough and lo-fi and all that kind of stuff. But we had such a good time making it. And the best part was we had something. It wasn't just one of those things where you sit around talking about an idea you want to do, but you never actually – I mean, Jem and I always like – bag each other because we always come up with ideas that just fucking never we have the list of unwritten unproduced projects that we have ideas that
tell me about it.
Keep talking about but never get fucking anywhere. But then I get quite inspired by what I see on social media, you know, like those people who just, you know, they'll go out and shoot something with their friends and upload it and there's no makeup artist, there's no lighting, there's no grip, there's no nothing. It's just they shoot it and upload it and then they'll just punch that stuff out like day after day. I think it's really, really inspiring.
Yeah. And exactly what you did with Lessons with Life, with
Lessons
with
for Richie Life. And, you disrespect.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah. Yeah. Sorry. Sorry. I just need to, yeah. Check out the website. You can watch it all on the, on the TV. Website. But no, that was inspiring for me to see you, Richie and Cam, just go and shoot something so simple and just make it happen. And that kind of, was exactly what I wanted to do with Colorblind. Was the amount of projects I'd had that I'd sat on for so long, or people had convinced me that I needed more development, or I needed to wait till I got to this point, and so many of them just fall off into the void. And 1, 2 years, 3 years later, you're like, fuck, I never made anything with that project, and I was so inspired by it at the time. So for me with Colorblind, it was like, I'm gonna shoot this. I'm doing it in 2 days. It is going to be what it is. And if I get something amazing, great. If I don't, I've still gone out there and I've made something that I wanted to. And I've creatively fulfilled something. So yeah, it was a win in that way, regardless. If no one had watched it at all, yeah, that'd be a little bit shit. But you know, I still would have got to have made the project.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's the most important thing.
100%. I mean, I think like you can be focused on outcome and, you know, we all want the stuff we work on to be successful, but I think that I really do believe like you learn more from your failures. Like I think that if the first thing you made, just say Colorblind was this huge fucking success, you know, that's great for you and whatever, but I think it gives you a warped view of how the world works. Like I often think that, you know, people who make their first feature film and it's an absolute, like, you know, goes gangbusters, and then they just sort of drop off the radar. They make a second film, it underwhelms people, and then they fall off. And I think, you know, it's almost almost a blessing and a curse in a way, because things came so easy the first time, you just assume they're going to happen again. Whereas the one thing I can say, I think I'm a person of medium talent. I don't think I'm exceptional in any regard. But one thing I do know I can do is apply myself and keep fronting up. Like that's how I got my acting career started, was I just kept fronting up. I just kept doing things until someone gave me an opportunity, and producing was the same. And, you know, hopefully with these other things, I'm just going to keep fronting up until someone gives me an opportunity. But it is that thing of, like you said earlier, You can't be at the expense of the rest of your life. You know, you don't want to be that person who is just always talking about, because that's, again, to reference the early conversation, that's what LA can feel like, where it's just constant hustling and projects. You know, you've got a beautiful wife and a beautiful daughter, and you've got a great circle of friends and a, you know, beautiful family. And, you know, that's more than a lot of people have. And I think that, you know, if you want to be holistic about it, you know, you're already winning. Like you're already in a really great position. You know, now you just want to get that other side of your life, you know, fulfilled. That's where you want to start, you know, expressing yourself and allowing your voice to get out there more.
Yeah, definitely. And have you found that since you've had Iona, that your perspective and your work or your writing's changed at all?
Yeah, I think so. You definitely, well, for me, I've become more emotional, a bit more sensitive to things, you know, like, I mean, on one hand, there is a motivation just to do well, to provide, you know, that's a pretty common instinct, I think, in most yeah. parents. But I do feel like, because it's such a, the experience of being a parent, it changes every day because the child changes every day. And there's stuff yeah. that you learn about yourself and there's stuff that you get challenged by. And I think that that is all fuel for, you know, stuff that you can create, whether or not you are literally writing a story about parenthood or more. For me, you know, I was caught up with Cam in Sydney a couple of weeks ago, and I was saying that the thing that being a parent that I was not expecting, and it's not like a positive thing, was that I have this like anger that, you know, the child, that like a crying child triggers in me. It's not like a conscious thing. It's obviously something deep inside of me that gets triggered. It's an anxiety response, you know, when she's woken up five times in the night and I'm fucking had no sleep. And, you know, there's, I just get this kind of flush of anger, which, you know, in my ordinary life, I think I'm quite even-minded and I don't really lose my temper that much. And I'm like, holy shit, like, this is what I'm like when I'm running on fumes. This is what I'm like when I'm not getting things my own way. And so that's something that I've been trying to explore is, you know, sort of just like the lessons or the programming we get from a young age. Because I think for me, there's a lot of my dad coming through in that. Like my memories of my father, you know, was that he was quite an anxious dude and he didn't respond well to stress and, you know, was quite uptight. And I see flashes of that. I'm like, holy fuck. It's so interesting to me because, you know, my father died when I was 10. So I didn't really have a lot of experience with him as an adult. So for me to think that I'm anything like my dad is bizarre because it's like, well, you know, I was just a kid, but I see it, you know, and I feel it. And I'm interested to talk with my older siblings about it to see if, you know, they have similar experiences because in so many ways, you know, your parents imprint on you without you even knowing it.
Yeah, and you do have such a pressure as a parent or in parenthood, knowing that you have this tiny, vulnerable little human that's growing and learning and picking up traits and, you know,
copying behavior,
learning lessons from you every day, whether it be you're going fuck at something or, you know, just getting annoyed at the smallest things. I think that's one thing that has hit me the most since having our daughter is just trying to be really present and live in the moment.
Yeah.
Because I think with this industry as well, like, you know, you can get lots of knockbacks. As you even said with the writing, there's so many times where things don't come to fruition that it can be easy to dwell on things or, you know, some people are better at brushing things off than others.
Yeah.
I think with a kid, you just don't really have that opportunity. You know, you're hands on, you're there, you're in it all the time.
Yeah.
And it's kind of that sense of irreverence that kind of keeps things fun and alive, right?
Yeah, the unpredictability. I mean, that's the way I've tried to reframe those moments where I get frustrated is that, like, to appreciate even that experience because it won't last forever. You know, she was a baby and then she was an infant and now she's a toddler. And I swear, man, it's gone so quick. And so that period of time where she wasn't sleeping and she was screaming in my face and stuff like that, you know, it's already gone. And in a weird way, I feel some nostalgia for that. It's like, oh, she wasn't, you know, she's not my little baby anymore. And so going forward, like I'm kind of enjoying or trying, at least making the effort to enjoy the challenge, the struggle when she's being stubborn or opposing me or, you know, she's very mummy oriented. So I get a lot of like, don't argues, you know, in the morning when they're having a cuddle in bed, I'll try and sneak in and she just like Dusty Martin, I'll just like stick the hand into my chest.
Yeah. The old palm.
The old palm. And, but even that I'm like, I love it, you know, like, cause this is, I'm watching her personality develop. I'm watching her make choices and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, as I get closer to the grave time, which feels to every
come on,
closer and closer, you know, I'm acutely aware of how each second, you know, that the passing of each second. And I think that's what a kid does for you is you actually now have a living hourglass that sort of shows you the passing of time, because they get bigger and they change all the time. And as they're getting bigger and changing, you're getting older. So you just really have to be in the moment.
Terrifying.
Yeah, it's really terrifying. Probably a good point to end it on, Ty. Thank you so much for doing the show. I'd love to have you back on. I mean, if there's ever a series two of Colorblind, is that something you've been thinking about?
Yeah, well, we're actually in the development phase at the moment.
Fantastic.
And fingers crossed, we've just submitted to Screen Australia. They were so incredible and such allies with us for the first part of it. So hopefully we can be bringing something fresh and funny to everyone really soon.
Cool. And we'll get you on regardless of whether it gets Screen Australia back to you or not.
You're holding me ransom. I have to make it season two.
It's good motivation. Thanks, Ty.
Thanks so much for having me.